sends a song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCItalk.org.
Good morning and welcome to this March 13th, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available to you via podcast. More information on that later this hour. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara DeMarco Barrett is here with authors, poets, literary agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. It is my honor and privilege to be joined for the entire hour by George Saunders, talking about, among many things, short stories and his latest collection, 10th of December. George Saunders is the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant, a Lannan Foundation, the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the Guggenheim Foundation. He is the author of the acclaimed several collections of short stories, including Civil War Land and In Bad Decline, as well as a collection of essays and a book for children. He teaches creative writing at Syracuse. His latest collection, The 10th of December, has been hailed by the New York Times as the best book you'll read this year, and they said that in January. It's my pleasure to welcome him for the hour. George, hi.
Hi, Marie. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Thanks. This is such a treat. So we'll start out with why the short story. The short story always, you know, sort of has been talked about as the ugly stepchild of the novel or something. I'm such a huge fan of short stories, but I'd love your take on what they do that novels can't do.
Well, I mean, you know, I think from the writer's point of view, in a way, you're sort of a slave to what you can do well, you know. And so I love novels, and I'd be happy to write one. But so far, this form is just kind of it for me. I know what to do in the short story form, and I get excited about it. So it hasn't really been that much of a choice. It's just kind of almost like an organic choice. You know, your body and your mind and your talent kind of tell you. But I just love the fact that you can do, say, 7 or 9 or 12 different things in one book. I mean, completely different things stylistically and aesthetically. And I like the urgency of the story. You know, the idea that just for a very short time, you're going to get the reader to kind of look at you closely, and you're going to communicate some really strange essential truth, and then kind of, you know, be gone in the next minute.
Yeah. Tell me about, talk a little bit about what inspired this collection, because it seems to have reached readers, a broader range of readers, in a different sort of, as you say, more urgent sort of way. And I'm wondering your thoughts on what this collection has done, how it's gotten into the reader's skin, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm kind of wondering that myself. I think if we talked back in November, I would have said, yeah, I wrote another weird, you know, kind of dark short story collection. It's kind of funny. And I think I would have said, now the next thing to do is to try to figure out how to reach out more broadly. And then, you know, it turns out this book has done it. So I know just as I'm, you know, moving through life, the urgency is sort of, I'm feeling the urgency more. And I think maybe one thing that happens with writing and with living is that you get a little more confident that the things that seem important and true to you actually are important and true. So when you're young, maybe you feel a certain thing, but if you haven't seen it exactly in literature, you think, well, that can't be valid. I haven't seen it before. Whereas when you get older, you start to think, well, you know, I'm 3,000 years old, and I've been through all the major life events, and so if this thing seems true to me, there must be a place for it in literature, and so it's just a matter of kind of insisting on that and finding a way to say it. So this book felt to me a little more, maybe honest, you know, maybe more forthright, more located on the things that really are interesting to me right now in some way.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to say without, it's not at all that I'm discounting the earlier work, but I suppose every book is sort of, if you're lucky, every book is a sincere expression of where you find yourself at that stage of life. And I think when I was younger, I had a little more anger and a little more amazement at the cruelty that was around. And now I have that still, but I also have a little bit more of a feeling that, you know, that we do have resources to bring to bear on those things, and that, you know, the baby might be near the cliff, but it doesn't always go over, I guess.
Right. So you think there's sort of a ray of more, I don't know if the word is compassion or something, for the human race than you had when you were a younger writer?
Well, yeah, and the funny thing is I had it as a person then, maybe even more. You know, in other words, I was kind of, I don't know if I was more open, but I think I didn't have the technical means or the confidence to express it. So, you know, it seems like as I'm writing longer, I just become more comfortable with things that I would have been unable to express 15 years ago because my expression of it at that time would have been or seemed to me banal. And now suddenly I'm kind of like, I could put that in the story, and I could make even this thing that might seem banal, I could say it in such a way that it actually would have style and would have some sort of literary power as well. So I think that's maybe just a matter of settling into your materials a little bit. You know, you kind of, and also like, you know, if you think of life as a party, you know, well, when you're at the party long enough, you kind of know all the rooms, and you kind of know who's there, and you kind of, you know what the limits are. So I think that leads to a little bit of increased confidence, maybe.
Do you think that's a function of life experience and just, you know, chronological living on the earth, or do you think that's a function of writing, you know, your experience in writing, both?
Yeah, I think both. I think, and it's funny how the two almost seem to be one thing. I mean, you have... you have experience, and then when you turn to write about them, you find the means available. Whereas when I was younger, I think I felt you have all this experience, but it seemed like only a tiny fraction of those things were expressible in the, you know, the means then available. So I think it's really both. It's having lived enough to feel like, yeah, you know, I mean, I might not know much about life, but I should, and, you know, anybody who's lived this long, you know, has some authority. And then at the same time, to have been working all those years and trying to find out how a story functions and how language works, how my particular language works, it seems like the two are kind of a little bit in tandem somehow.
Yeah. I'm curious about this notion that I've read about you, that language, word choice, is really sort of the guiding light in writing the stories, and that the content and the characters kind of are born out of specific attention to language and the sonic quality of the language. I'd love for you to talk about that.
Well, I mean, like all, you know, I guess like all process-related questions, that's kind of an my version of this is kind of an approximation of what actually happens, but I found out pretty early that if I had a big idea about a story or a point I wanted to make or a theme, it was just a shutdown. Like I would, you know, the story would be so laden with my intention that it would just be a one-way conversation. And so somehow I figured out that for me, to sort of think of it as a bit of a performance that I'm giving for you, and I'm supposed to be watching you very closely as I do the performance to see how I'm doing. You know, it's a sort of see, are you leaning in? Are you paying attention? Are you, what concerns do you have? What expectations am I engendering? And that way of thinking about it was really helpful for me. I'm not sure why. I mean, I used to play music, and I did a little bit of stand-up, but to say there's a reader out there who's just as smart as you, just as morally engaged, just as experienced, now engage her. That seemed to be, I had a big breakthrough around that moment, and with one other, you know, sort of twist on it, which is that reader, you know, essentially is me if I hadn't already read the story. So it's kind of hard to articulate, but as I'm working, and especially as I'm reading the stuff I've already written, I just sometimes imagine like a little meter or something, you know, in my forehead, and it's got positive on one side and negative on the other, and I just want to kind of with a very light touch, kind of see where that needle's going at the moment. So if you're on page one and it's kind of pegging up in the positive, that's good. And then, you know, every so often you'll hit a patch where the pleasure goes down, and that's the place where revision has to happen. Sometimes it's word choice, just kind of a kind of false idea or a kind of funny construct. But it's kind of hard to describe, but it's very visceral, I guess.
Yeah. Your comment about how attentive you are to word choice just strike me as, you know, how close the short story is to poetry, and you know, the actual specific words can come in, and the sound of them almost might, you know, change the whatever the character wants, or
totally,
kind of
yeah.
change the tone of the story.
Yeah, and the beauty of it, and maybe this goes back to your earlier question about the story. In a 4 or 5 page or 10 page article, you know, or artifact, the reader's attention can be really, really high. And if you think of a story as kind of a linear temporal event, you know, you start at sentence one and you work your way through, the reader and the writer are really shoulder to shoulder in a good story, so that even a comma or even a weird bit of punctuation or, as you say, a different word can really change the trajectory in a way that both the reader and the writer can kind of feel. It's almost like writing, I sometimes think of it as being like one of those motorcycle sidecar deals, you know, and in a well-told story, you and the reader are just right next to each other. When you lean left, you both lean left. And when you go over a bump, you both go over a bump. And in a story that's less refined, you know, the sidecar might be a quarter mile away or something, so that, you know, there's an uncertain connection between the two. So for me, that process is just going through it just a bunch of times, kind of obsessively, with this conceit that I can imagine what I would think of the story if I hadn't been working on it for 4 months.
Yeah.
So it's a way to madness, but it, you know.
You raise a good point about punctuation, and your attention and detail to punctuation and how it changes from story to story. Your punctuation almost has a language in and of itself of, you know, whether you decide to use quotation marks or whether you decide to use colons or M dashes. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how, you know, right down to commas, how you create that voice for your characters that changes even, you know, even with the choice to use a quotation mark or not.
Sure. Well, I think it's a little bit like, I'm a guitar player, and I noticed that if you play the same guitar for many years, you kind of figure out where, there are all kinds of things you can do with that instrument that someone coming to it the first time wouldn't know about. So, for example, certain parts of the fretboard are hotter than others. The switches have certain quirks. Where you play with your right hand along the, you know, makes a big difference. And so I think a story is kind of like that. If you've worked on it long enough and you've been inside it long enough, you kind of become aware of all the different spheres of influence that you have in that piece. Or maybe you could say you become super heightened to the malleability of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that too is a function of this method of just iteration, you know, going back to a story again and again and again and again. Because pretty soon, you know, if you've worked on a paragraph long enough, you can kind of see all the side rooms that are possible. And you can see, again, on a gut level, you can see what this little punctuation change does. But I think the only way to do that is to really be immersed in it for a long time so that it almost becomes the case that you're speaking to the story in a language that's not even a real language. You're in such a close relation to it that you're just feeling it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. This is where it gets a little gauzy because I can't really articulate it. But for me, the answer to all of the questions is just go back to it again and again and again. And the story will actually, you know, kind of like a shy person, a story will resist at first. It doesn't want you to know its secrets. But as you kind of abide and listen and are polite, will occasionally blur something out to sort of repay your attention, and the story is very much like that, I think.
Hmm. How do you get that fresh eye perspective that you have to go over a story so many times and yet be able to see it with the new-eyed, fresh perspective that you need to, you know, to have that distance of what the reader is going to experience?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, and I think probably everybody has their own tricks, and I actually think, you know, the one thing over the 20 or 25 years of writing that I've done that I can tell has improved is this thing you're talking about, where I can come back to something with a much shorter absence and feel refreshed. And I don't know, to some extent, I think that might just be something your brain learns to do on its own, to kind of wipe clean, you know, the preconceptions that you had about the story an hour ago. Mm-hmm. And then I think there are some little tricks, I mean, you know, like exercise or playing music or going out and doing something that totally takes you, you know, falling off a mountain, that would be good, or, you know, hitting your head or something. But, I mean, I think there are tricks. But for me, I've noticed that just sort of, and I don't have an explanation, but I've noticed that over the years of writing, I'm more capable of coming back to something and starting over. And I don't really know why. I think it might just be an adaptive thing that your brain does. When you ask it to do that often enough, it might eventually go, oh, right, I will. But maybe partly, too, you know, the process of saying, you know, okay, paragraph 8, I've read you a million times, I break with thee, you know, I don't have any allegiance to you, all those ideas I have about why you're necessary and why you're wonderful, I break with those too. I think sometimes just mechanically saying that stuff somehow gives your mind permission to take a step backward, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to talk about this stuff because it's very visceral.
In the DNA, sort of, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if you, because I haven't heard the audio version of the book, but I've heard it's fantastic, but I wonder if you have the experience of reading it out loud versus reading it on the page versus, you know, some of these have been turned into plays, whether, you know, your experience of it can be kind of, you can jar yourself out of it by hearing it in a different medium.
Yeah, I don't usually, I mean, when I'm working on a piece, I don't read it aloud, and I keep it to myself. So most of the stuff has to do with this, you know, day-by-day reinvention. But it is interesting when you try to read something aloud, because I find that I can hear, well, this probably is not the kind of thing you want to say on radio, but I can hear voices that are much more nuanced than I can actually do on stage.
Mm.
So in the stories, You know, I think if you're working right, you don't really know what you did. You know what you think you did, or you know what it felt like you did when the story first came out, but it's the freaky thing about being a writer is that stuff is always changing. You know, what was perfect on Wednesday can suck on Thursday, and vice versa. So I think I've loved seeing the play versions and getting the chance to read the audiobook, because it just sort of knocks you out of this delusion that you are exactly equal to your work. You know, you see that you did your best, and you're pretty happy with it at the time it comes out. But then even a couple months later, you read it aloud, and you're like, I don't know. I don't know what that is. You know, that's different than I thought it was.
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of refreshing.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is George Saunders. The short story collection is the 10th of December. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You've talked a couple of times about some of these stories being inspired by dreams and the importance of dreams. I think there were a couple of mentions of dreams in stories. And I wanted to talk about your experience of translating whatever that really weird, amorphous emotional experience that you have in dreams to short stories, and how many times that's happened.
Sure.
That gift has been given to you.
Yeah, it's only happened, I think, 3 times. And, of course, the number of times I've woken up from a dream and said I should write that is probably in the hundreds. But, you know, the penguins having, you know, a mass orgasm on the top of the Empire State Building, that one you discard. But every so often there's a certain flavor of a dream that I've had maybe 3 or 4 times where you wake up and you try to shake it off and it sticks around. Or, you know, the other test is if I just go to the computer and write it down and then, you know, come back the next day and sometimes it just looks like gibberish. But the 3 or 4 times it's happened to me, it's funny, you know, they've always come at times when I needed them. Like there were times when I had a deadline or was at kind of an artistic crossroads, and just out of the blue, some team player in my subconscious would sort of go, oh, here, have this one, you know. So in this book, I think that Semko Girl Diaries is the only one that came out of a dream, and that was a vivid, perfect, like a movie dream, you know. So I don't know, it's kind of interesting, you know, that they're I'm sure that that's the same source that's giving you your language day to day when you're writing a story. But it's funny that every so often your subconscious will kind of run ahead and say, this poor schmuck needs some help. Let me put this, you know, perfect story idea on the trail in front of him, and hopefully he'll trip over it and pick it up.
And yet that story you said took you 14 years to write. So there was, you know, the temporal distance between having the dream and you know, publication of the story was a long time. What happened in those 14 years?
Oh, God. Well, our kids grew up and left home. And, I don't know. You know, I think the idea was actually so deep and so kind of puzzling that it took that long to figure out what to do with it. The image itself was pretty complete, but then to make that into a story was the big trick. So I think part of it is, you know, that in that particular case, the dream had a real freighted kind of political meaning that was simple, and maybe too simple. And so if you just wrote that story, it would seem like a lecture. But the trick over those 14 years, I think, was to try to figure out how do we preserve the original quality of the dream and then do that sort of something else that would make it into an actual story. And I'm a real trial and error person, so that's a little scary. You know, trial and error is okay, but you don't want to build a bridge with it. So as the ideas get more complicated and the sort of natural arc of a story gets longer, you can get a really scary thing where you go, yeah, I could finish this story, but it would just take me 80 years, you know. So.
The trick also seems to be knowing which ideas to pay attention to, you know, why you don't pay attention to the penguin at the top of the Empire State Building, but you do to the, you know, paper dolls in your yard and knowing the potential of the idea, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, partly that just comes from having tried that penguin idea, you know, many times in my youth, and cause wouldn't it be nice if, you know, every time you had a dream, it was a story? That would be great. But what I found is art does not, it just won't work on a system, you know, And it's one of the funny things about talking about this book a lot is you always feel like you sound like you have a system, but the real system is to not have a system and to be kind of go in there every day and go, I don't know what I'm doing. I've been doing this a long time, and I'm supposed to know what I'm doing, and I teach it, but oh, my God, I'm so lost, you know. And that's actually a pretty high state of mind to actually occupy that kind of openness is really, really challenging, and it's and over the years, that's the thing I've really come to love about this job, is that you, it just, you know, art is such a harsh taskmaster. It won't take an imitation of that idea. It only wants that idea. It really demands that you be open, and if you're not, it'll go, okay, stupid. You know, it's been 4 years, and then, you know, so it's great training for not being kind of addicted to some idea of mastery or accomplishment, you know, the idea that, oh, now I've made it, I can just go on autopilot the rest of my career. That is death, you know.
There's no tenure in writing, I guess.
There's no tenure in writing, absolutely. That's a great way to say it, yeah.
Right.
Exactly right. And I think, that, you know, that's so true of so many things in life. I mean, I think for your relationships, for your spiritual life, as soon as you start coasting, you're done. And so maybe the job is every day to just sort of, you know, start over every day, which part of us, I think, you know, would love to go on autopilot and just say, okay, now that I've, you know, realized some spiritual truth, or I have a good relationship, or know how to write, now I can really kick back and relax. But I don't think that's it.
That's, that's when you're move into leisure world or something, and things go drastically downhill.
Yeah.
I do wonder, in talking about this book so much and being interviewed about it and having so many readers give you their feedback, if your experience of the stories change in light of sort of all of this digestion that you have to do with it and in talking about it and thinking about it, or is your experience of the stories as they came out, you know, a pretty constant thing that's kind of locked in your mind?
No, I mean, even that was malleable. I mean, you could have one experience when you send it off to the magazine and another one as you're working through it. And then even, you know, I've had the experience of reading final proof and going, wait, that's, you know, oh, wow. So I'm all right with that. And it's actually been a lot of fun to go out and hear a lot of people having opinions about the book, including negative ones. You know, it's been really kind of invigorating, because I think it reminds you that, you know, like I said earlier, I'm not a particular story. The story is sort of a manifestation of hopefully of your kind of joy or your creative energy at a given moment. You do the best you can, and in my case, I really obsess over it. But then, you know, when it goes out, it's just a thing. It's not it's not a creed. You know, it's not actual events. It's just a kind of a Yelp, you know, that you made at a certain time. And I think the reward is that you get to make a Yelp. You get to have a say. You know, you get to do a little dance. But then if the next day you were saying, did you see my dance? Was it good? You know, or watching it repetitively on YouTube or something, that would be kind of not a sign of health. So I think that the best thing is to go, when I'm in a story, I believe in it 100%, and I'm trying to make it everything it can be. And when you're done, it's just a thing you did, you know,
mm-hmm.
And on to the next one. Rinse, lather, and repeat until you die at the writing table at 180 with a smile on your face.
I love that.
Hopefully.
I love that, yeah, hopefully. Right.
Yeah.
I'm curious about what outside of your life feeds this the most. You've talked about having a childhood in Catholicism and sort of the rigor of language that gave you and kind of the rigor of ritual. You've talked about being a musician. I'm wondering if there are you know, elements outside of your writing life that are all feeding the writing life.
Yeah, well, I'd like to think everything, you know, everything that happens to you, including, you know, even going on a book tour, should do something to kind of complicate your view of human beings. My wife and I are Buddhist practitioners, and that's been a really incredibly rich source of just, you know, everything. So I think, you know, my feeling is you kind of, you don't really know what the world is, but you have a chance to cut a vector through a certain part of it. And my thought of the writer's job is just to be kind of looking and listening and trying to reject any tendency to have a hard and fast idea about the world, but just let it keep correcting you, you know. And then my other assumption is that whatever corrections you're undergoing in real life will eventually percolate into your work, but you don't really have to worry about how or where. You know, you don't have to control it, or I'm not a big note taker. I kind of just feel like you go stand in the weather, you know, it affects you, and you come back in and you write, and then there's sort of a natural conduit between whatever you've experienced and your aesthetic process.
I love that. And I wonder if your empathy and compassion have grown. You said that you had them all the way along, but they've grown in your writing over the years. And I'm wondering if you're kind of thinking about your characters and their capacity and their, you know, kind of range of emotion have changed over the years of your writing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, all those things, I think what they have to do with is attention. So this method we talked about earlier of kind of coming back to the story again and again and focusing on the language, it has a weird way of kind of embodying that that bit from Philadelphia Story where she says the time to make up your mind about a person is never. Because it seems to me like when you're revising, what you're really doing is you're taking your initial caricature of a person that you threw in there for some reason known to you. Maybe you want to parody the person. Maybe you need the person to deliver a letter. Maybe it's the love interest, whatever. You have some sketch of a person there. And then by going back again and again and again, and I can't defend this, but here's my experience. If you go back again and again trying to make the language something special, which parenthetically might mean trying to make it more truthful, more efficient, more intelligent, funnier, if you do those things, mysteriously, that the result that comes off is it looks like empathy. Mm-hmm. In other words, it looks like you are seeing into the crevasses of the person's soul a little bit more. I mean, I can give you a simple example of what I mean. If you start with something like, you know, some bad sentence, like Bob was an idiot, that's your first draft. All right, so if you come back to that, you kind of feel that it's not exactly Dickens, you know. And so you might say, well, you know, why? Give me an example. So the next draft would be Bob snapped at the young cashier. So that's already better because it's active and it's an action rather than an assertion. Okay. And then you think, all right, so I wonder why he did that. And then you say, Bob snapped at the youthful cashier because she reminded him of, you know, and then you let that sit. You know, oh, and then you say, oh, she reminded him of his late wife. And suddenly already you're in a much more interesting space where the guy isn't just an idiot. He's somebody who's grieving, and his grief has taken the form of aggression. And now, not only that, but as a bonus, he's standing right across from this young girl that he's just snapped at, who reminds him of his wife because of the way she, you know, brushes her hair behind her ear. Mm. So just in that, in just trying to, you know, eradicate that boring sentence, Bob's an idiot, you've sort of, I would argue, become a more empathetic narrator.
Teased out why he's an idiot, right?
Yeah, but he's not, he's not really, you'd be hard-pressed to call him an idiot now. You know, oh, it's Bob, poor Bob, you know,
right.
Poor grieving Bob. So I don't know that I'm, you know, necessarily a more empathetic person by having written that, but the story has become sort of more generous. And I think this is true even if you're like Flannery O'Connor and you're not inclined to be merciful to Bob, but being antagonistic to Bob in a very specific way will somehow give the effect of greater fairness, I think, something like that.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's weird. It has the problem of sounding a little new age, you know, to say, oh, you can just become more empathetic by writing. I don't think that's quite true, but I do notice that when I concentrate on a character, I tend to start being more fair and kind of liking him, even if he's not a great guy, or maybe beyond liking, you start to sort of see how things might look to that person, even if you totally object to the way they seem to that person.
Were there characters in this collection who gave you a particularly hard time in that regard, people who you found it harder to get into and harder to empathize with?
Yeah, I mean, there's a story called Al Rustin I just started that as kind of a parody of a kind of a certain kind of middle-aged white dude, you know, who kind of lives for himself and you know, always sees himself as the center of all narratives, kind of like myself. And then, so I had some fun with him, you know, kind of making a fool of him a little bit. And then I think the challenge there was to try to figure out a way to, not make it just a beat down and try to see, you know, is there anything in you that would sort of explain the way you feel or make us feel a little more sympathetic? Because I think one of the tricks of the short story is that, you know, if you use it just to kick somebody, the reader doesn't like that so much. The reader feels that it's not a fair setup. You know, you chose to write a story about a person that you wanted to kick and could kick. That doesn't seem like a fair thing. So one of the strange, maybe deformities of the story form is that I would say you have to give the character some kind of chance to alter whatever negative thing he or she is in. So like this Christmas, A Christmas Carol would be an example. It's a short novel, but you know, if Scrooge was a really crappy guy, stingy guy, mean guy, and he just stayed that way, it's not a story.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's, so with this Al Rustin, and there's another story in an earlier book called The Barber's Unhappiness, which is on the same model, where, you know, you have a lot of fun teasing a person and kind of making fun of them, and then you realize that the story will flatline if there isn't some little flicker of hope for this guy to sort of at least have a tiny moment of realization or something like that. So that one took a while to kind of, you know, and it's just done again on the phrase by phrase. You know, you'll be writing along and you've got a good joke, you put it in there, and you go, you know, that's a little harsh. Is that really? And also you say, is that really true? You know, would a person really think that? And then you might just dial it back a little bit, and in the dialing it back, suddenly he thinks or says something. In this case, he has a sister, you know, who's out of work, and she's dependent on him, and that's his Achilles heel. You know, his kindness to her is the thing that kind of appeared out of nowhere. I didn't even know she existed, and then suddenly she did. You know,
right? Right. And giving characters little moments of grace and ways out or something. Yeah. I am speaking this morning with George Saunders. The book is 10th of December. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. You always remind me of sort of the Charlie Kaufman of writing, because
thank you. That's high praise.
It's this experience of, you know, it's a world I recognize, but it's been tweaked a little bit, and, you know, I'm right there with you, but I'm wondering how much you set up these rules of the kind of alternate world. It feels very seamless, but it must be very conscious and intentional of how you make that leap with the reader from real world to almost real world, but not quite. And the way both you and Charlie Kaufman do that, I think, is just masterful. I have no idea how you do it, though.
Well, thank you. Well, I mean, the way I do it is, it goes back to that revision idea. You know, you sort of, like with that Semco Girl story that came out of a dream, I had this image of this weird thing, and then it's kind of like, okay, now wait a minute, how does that happen? You know, what are the, how do those, you know, those paper doll girls get into his yard? How do they pay for them? How much are they? All the millions of details that, and I think I'm not somebody who would figure those out beforehand. It's mostly just trying to write, you know, the scene where they show up, or the scene where they get their meal or something like that. And a lot of this stuff gets cut later, but it seems to me that if prose, you know, if prose quality is somehow related to truthfulness, then you're better off trying to write the thing out to see how it could actually happen, you know. So for me, it's a lot of iteration, just going through it again and again and trying to, you know, it's funny, like in a sci-fi type of a story, a speculative story, there's always that cheesy moment where one character turns to the other and describes, you know, as you know, robots have ascended to a position of importance. They are impossible to distinguish from humans, Jim. And Jim goes, I know, Ralph, you know. So that's bad sci-fi. So what you'd want to do is cut that and try to get the ideas occurring kind of the way they would to a person actually living in that world. Like in our case, you know, if somebody was writing, you know, in the 1930s was writing a story about now, and they said, you know, Marie picked up her cell phone, which was a small device used to call people far away. There's something false about that because we don't think of it that way.
Right.
So for me, it's just going through the story hundreds and hundreds of times and trying to eliminate all those false notes. And in the process, you find out funny things about the world that you're making up. And often those things are kind of gold because they're the things that show you that even in some futuristic world, the basic human tendencies are still asserting themselves. Like I had a story years ago where this guy ran, the idea was he was going to sell holographic experiences. And so I put him in this kind of yucky mall, and the shop was faltering. And the thing that really sold was porn, you know, like holographic porn. And the people who came in weren't exactly stellar citizens. And so to me, that seemed like kind of the way it would actually be. You know, the way if we ever get great holography, you know, we're not going to be watching War and Peace with it. We're going to So anyway, it's that kind of thought.
That's how the internet has turned out, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that process, but enacted through, you know, many, many revisions.
Yeah, it does strike me that in the paring down, I guess that the sci-fi is sort of parallel to the humor, that if you first start out kind of overwriting it, and then the strength of it is in the paring back and the
exactly.
trusting the reader to make that leap with you.
Yeah, it's that Hemingway, you know, I don't know if people still talk about this, but that Hemingway iceberg theory, you know, that if you know something, put two-thirds of it underwater, and the thing still has its weight, still has its gravity, even though you can only see the one-third above it. So if you have, for example, with the humor, you know, often I'll find myself in a quote-unquote final version. I'll have three versions of the same joke, and you're like, nah, that doesn't, you can't do that. You gotta, because then you get the feeling of a clever writer behind it, sort of touting his stuff. Whereas if you cut it to the best of the three, you get full credit for it, plus a little extra for efficiency. So yeah, I think that pruning instinct is really, really important.
Yeah. And just having the ear for it without having readers outside of it to tell you where you need to be pruning. I assume
right. You know, and that's a great point, because that's one of the things, you know, I teach at Syracuse and I do a lot of talking about writing and everything. And one of the things that strangely is unsaid is that a lot of what we do is ear or some unnamed gift that you just sort of have. And I think one of the pitfalls of MFA land is that we act as if everything can be taught and everything is equally available to everybody. But just like in acting or sports, you know, there are kind of mystery skills that you have or you don't. And if you have them and you execute them, you can always kind of make up a rhetoric about it. You know, well, one must always this, one must never this. But the truth is, it's kind of, you know,
yeah.
I mean, if you take Serena Williams and somebody who's much less talented, they probably would both say the same thing about technique, but the reason Serena beats that other person is because she's got this sort of instinct. So I think part of what we try to do as writers is figure out where, in the 360 degrees of things we can do as writers, where are our little pods of sort of mystical excellence, you know, where we just know how to do these things. And it might not even be the thing you want to do. You know, you might not even want to be that kind of writer. I never really thought of myself as being a humorous writer, but then I found out that I could kind of make that stuff work better than I could the elegiac scenes in the forest, you know, so
right.
There you go.
Then you wrote that Ayn Rand piece for The New Yorker and found out you couldn't avoid humor if you wanted to.
No, yeah, I've been loving that Flannery O'Connor quote about, you know, you can choose what you write, but you can't choose what you make live.
Yeah.
And that seems to be it's kind of a sad, you know, in some ways it can be sad. When I first had a long drought, and then I wrote this story that sold, and it was called The Wavemaker Falters from the first book. Short, kind of pithy, funny, dark, kind of, but a little bit slight, it seemed to me. And I was a little bit like, oh, God, you know, I kind of wanted to be Chekhov. But then you think, well, you know, if you can do something that's even a little bit just yours, that's pretty good, you know, and so you got to kind of suck it up.
Yeah, yeah. I guess lying in there is the question of how much, you know, innate talent you need for this versus how much, you know, could anybody, given the time and fortitude, sit down and become a writer? Or, you know, is that special spark in there, you know, sort of a necessity?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I don't think it's the case that anybody given enough time can do it. I think anybody given enough time can get better. And I think that's a really worthy thing to do, whether you get published or not. I think the trajectory one follows in trying to express yourself, you know, better is valuable no matter what. But I think I don't think it's the case that anybody can sit down and do it. I that would be strange in a way, you know. In other words, it's to say, oh, anybody could be a baseball player if you just practice. It's not true. And so I think that's, and I think most people who do it are hoping to find out that they have a special spark. And maybe that thing we call craft is actually just putting in the hours to find out if you do, and more importantly, where you do. You know, what is the one thing that I can do that nobody else can do? I don't think people just sit down and figure that out. At least I sure didn't. That took me a long time to go, oh, my God, there isn't much I can do, and it's very minor. So I'm going to spend the rest of my life working this very, very modest seam. But even that came after 15 years of trying to trying other things and kind of going, yeah, that's not it.
Yeah. I wonder if every writer has to go through that phase of trying on other writers' skin, you know. First, I'm going to read this guy for a while and, you know, try my hand at that. And then
did you go through that?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I think I might still be going through that.
You? Oh, no. Shoot higher. I actually think my experience is that everyone does that, because if you have a good ear and you're inclined to love writing, then there's going to be somebody who nails you, you know, somebody who just blows your doors off. For me, it was Hemingway and then Isaac Bobble and Kerouac a little bit. But I think that would be natural to somebody who is, just like if you had a great musical ear, you know, the first time you heard Coltrane or whoever it might be for you, Neil Young, you know, you'd go, that's it, that's what I want to do. And then I think that's good practice, actually, for a few years to labor under the assumption that you're going to be Kerouac too, yeah. You know. And then at some point you go, hey, wait a minute, this isn't working out. And I think what happened for me that was really wonderful is, you know, I could do a pretty passable imitation of Kerouac and a pretty passable imitation of Hemingway, but when I did, I would feel this kind of lonely feeling like, hey, my life isn't representable in your language, sir. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It really isn't. Some of it is. And I think we all had that experience of trying to shape our reality so it sounds more Hemingway-esque, you know, or feels more Hemingway, or whoever your person is. But there's that really moment of truth kind of thing where you say, you know, these things have happened to me. I know these things to be true, and I'm not seeing it in the work of my hero. Therefore, I have to kill the father, you know, and have to go over here and try to find the language for my own experience. And that's the holy moment, I think.
But some of him, right. But some of him sort of trails along, right? Your brevity of sentences and your short-clipped sentence style.
Yes.
You know, probably trails along from the people that you studied and read, I would think.
Absolutely. I think that's true for everybody. You know, you go through and you're changed by these writers, and you retain whatever is relevant to you, and then you keep, and, you know, you make this kind of strange soup of all the different influences, and then hopefully at the end, some little, you know, light that is you kind of animates the whole, it animates the soup, you know?
Yeah,
like a flashlight in the soup, I don't know, something.
So you've had a couple of words of advice for your students that I read that I loved. So I'll just repeat them back to you.
Okay. I hope I still stand by them.
Right. So aunts and uncles are best construed as the biological equivalent of small-scale weather systems.
Oh, yeah. No, that was just a spoof on the idea of having formulas. You know, there are some, I mean, you can see some people who give writing advice will have definite do's and don'ts, you know, and I think that's you. There's nothing that's disallowed. So I think that riff was just kind of me pulling out a few false ones.
I do like, you know, kind of the balance that you struck between your minor characters and your main characters and what rich lives everybody had in the story. You know, nobody got short shrift and nobody escaped your sort of empathetic view of them, even though they, you know, they weren't a major player in the story.
Well, thanks. I think that, too, is maybe, you know, it's a function of seeing everybody as a person, but also as a language entity. You know, like if you have somebody who's doing a walk-on, first you should have vetted to make sure that she needs to be walking on, and then two, have some sense of why she's walking on. And then you can give just a little, since she's got eight lines, you know, you can try to make those eight lines actually do some work. You know what I mean? Like I think I remember there was a time, and I probably still do this, but there's a time whenever I had to have two people, let's say two policemen, there would always be a fat cop and a skinny cop, you know. And I think I still do that, actually. But it's kind of lazy, you know, to say, okay, fat, skinny, bald, not bald. So I think to take those eight lines and say, okay, I've already sort of made the down payment on these eight lines. Is there any way I can get one more beat of fun in there, you know, or signification or something? And if you give yourself enough time, you usually can find some little quirk of, like I was yesterday talking to a guy at a car dealership, and he had this really interesting trait that he was looking very concerned as I tried to explain this problem my car was having, and whenever I would make a hand gesture, he would exactly mimic that hand gesture. You know, it was almost like that being in a mirror or something. So that's something that I could use someday, you know. I'll just retain that and see if I can graft it onto somebody, because I think it would write well. You could have one or two sentences that would really nail that, and I feel that it would probably produce a little comic payoff at the end, you know. So I kind of hoard those things up a little bit.
Do you walk around with a notebook and sort of record snippets?
No, my feeling is the mental notebook is the best one, because if something fades from your mental notebook, it probably shouldn't have been there anyway. I've had so many bad experiences of going to a notebook and going, oh, I'll use this. And then you're kind of putting an uninvited guest into the story, you know. Whereas I think if you just remember what you remember, that's a lighter connection, and those things will tend to find their way a little more naturally than if you've got this list of seven things that you want to do. I've stopped keeping notebooks years ago, and I kind of just figure if I don't remember it, then I probably it's just a troublemaker anyway.
Yeah.
But I know great writers who keep, you know, copious notebooks. So
yeah, I have talked to Janet Fitch, who her notebooks are bigger than her novels, and
yeah.
You always wonder, you know, if it all gets served, or, you know, I mean, it's, I guess it's however you you commit things to your brain. But
maybe for novelists too, I could imagine, you know, for example, with a novel, maybe you just need more places and more things and more stuff. With a story, I think, at least in my model of the story, it should be a really efficient machine, and so you don't want to be introducing things into your machine that aren't necessary. So what I tend to do is look at the story as a series of pulses that, you know, a pulse causes the next pulse, which causes the next pulse, and there's a pattern of increased meaning as you go. So that means you kind of don't want to be distracted by a cool detail or a line of overheard dialogue, because those things might not fit the pattern. So my inclination is more to have the pattern, and when I'm in the pattern, go, okay, I need this. I need a guy to communicate information X. Then just go, okay, I need a guy. What do I have? And at that point, maybe that guy at the car dealership will come in.
Mm-hmm.
Not because there's any particular value in representing him, but just because I need a guy, and I need a guy with a little bit of detail, and he's been hanging around my mind for 3 weeks, and he fits the purpose, you know. So in other words, it's sort of like if you have a really tightly made play, it's like a mathematical equation. There should be no wasted moves. And so if you have stuff that you want to get in there, that sometimes can cause a wasted move, I think. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm also curious about when in the point of the story you know what the story is really about, because it sounds like in your process, you know, it's kind of 99% revision, and not knowing where the story is headed at the beginning, you know, so that you also can be surprised. Where is the point where you say, okay, this is what it is, and now it's a, you know, now it's a process of bringing that out, or,
yeah,
you know, maybe it keeps changing as you're revising it, I don't know.
It does keep changing, and that's the best case, is it changes up until the very last minute. And I've had that happen. And other times, you know, you kind of see it coming earlier, and then the trick is to not just fall into doing what you think you're going to do. Like always to keep it, to keep the possibility open that some surprise could be yielded at the last minute. Like in the first story in the book is called Victory Lap, and I had sent that off to the New Yorker with a different ending. And there's one additional beat in the story in the last two or three pages that wasn't there until maybe, I think it was while we were closing the story, and it was almost like my subconscious had been racing to catch up, and at the very last minute it gave me this one extra beat that, in my kind of mapping of the story, in the version I sent to them, the action had stopped escalating, say, a page and a half before the ending. It was still, you know, you still wanted to hear what was being said, but there hadn't been a new twist in a page and a half, in the last page and a half. And then with this thing, suddenly, just at the very end, there's one more little complication. So that's the kind of thing that you're really hoping for. So I think the working hypothesis is you have to both have kind of a point-in-time idea of what the story is doing, but you also have to be really open to having that overturned and even hopeful that it will be overturned. But I kind of think mostly, you know, for me, it's I'm like a bear of little brain, and if I think thematics, I get blocked. But if I just think the story is a series of, you know, related events, that one event causes the next, and somehow the heat goes up through the end, then mostly what you're doing is you're saying, okay, I'm on page four. It seems like these the first four pages satisfy that. Now, what would be the next meaningful thing that could happen? What's the rhetoric of the argument I'm making here, and what's the most interesting thing that could happen next? So you're kind of just looking one event into the future, and if you can get the right event that raises the temperature, then you clean that up, and then you're ready for the next one. So the perfect idea would be, you know, a series of escalating events that aren't trivial. Like there's a Hemingway story called Indian Camp. That's an incredible example of that. I do an exercise where I divide it into two-page sections, and we read it two pages at a time. We read two pages and stop. And, if anybody ever wanted to know what escalation is, that story is an incredible little lab experiment of continual escalation, even to the last two lines of the story.
Right. I love also the dance between the subconscious and the conscious, you know, that you have the editor and the attention to detail conscious mind that's, you know, always in sort of dialogue with the subconscious mind that's saying, you know, here's the really interesting idea, or here's a crazy dream that you should make something of. And then, you know, your overt mind has to come in and say, but the comma goes here.
No, that's exactly, it's a really wonderful combination of, you know, you're kind of, I often thought, especially if you're doing a lot of revising, you're kind of, you know, it kind of sounds crazy, but you're basically asking multiple versions of yourself, maybe thousands of versions of yourself, to step into the writing room for a day, weigh in, and then leave. And then the next day, a different you comes in. So the kind of idyllic idea would be that over the course of your year of working on your story, you've had so many manifestations of yourself come visit that the resulting product is more than you could ever be on a given day. It's the sum total of all these different people that you very generously allowed to come in. You know, cranky you came in, and anal retentive you came in, and celebratory egotist came in, and everybody came in. And they each had their say, and in the end, there's this thing. And the thing is some mysterious artifact of, you know, you, but, you know, you couldn't have done it on the first day, no way.
Right, exactly. Oh, we're drawing down on our time. Are there things that we should have talked about that we didn't talk about?
No, we talked about everything we should have talked about. It's a miracle.
That's funny because I have about 25 more pages to talk about.
Well, you're a great interviewer.
This was so much fun. George Saunders, thank you so much.
Thank you. That was a pleasure.
That was George Saunders. The book is 10th of December, and it is out now. It is wonderful. This was better than spending an hour with Brad Pitt for me. This was fantastic. That is all the time we have for today. Barbara is going to be here with you next week at this time. We have a speaker series event coming up next Tuesday night, March 19th. An evening with novelists at the Scape Gallery in Corona Del Mar. If you haven't signed up for that, I recommend you check out Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for details on that. This interview will be shortly podcasted up there as well for you to listen if you missed any part of it today. Other than that, stay tuned for a little bit of reggae coming up next, and Barbara will be here with you next Wednesday morning at 9. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. Walk away from me, child.